In the talk yesterday evening, I was asking the question, what is it that we really want? And I would like to go a little bit further into that again this evening. When Gautama, the awakened one, was in this area and sitting under the tree, he, later on in the years, he reported to his friends, his companions, events which occurred under there. And he formulated his perceptions, his realizations in a very simple, one might say, pragmatic way, in which he said that he realized that there was and there is suffering in life, that its presence is known, experienced and felt by sentient beings. He also realized that in order for there to be forms of suffering and the countless expressions, that there's factors, there's contributing conditions and causes for that suffering to arise. And he said that he also realized that there was a cessation to it. It didn't have to be this way. And there were and are various ways and means to certainly alleviate suffering, to diminish its influence and its pervasiveness, and to restore life to well-being and to health and to liberation. And with this, which he called, referred to as the Four Noble Truths, we might say in our contemporary language, four major truths of life, with the second one, the causes and the conditions, what he pinpointed specifically was what is known in the Pali language as Tanha, T-A-N-H-A, which we translate into English as wanting, the wanting mind, the mind which desires. So he could have said a whole variety of factors which contribute to suffering, social, political, economic, psychological circumstances, the kind of contact with situations that we have, all would be contributing ones towards suffering which we as human beings and other species experience. And what that was picked out of all the possibilities and named specifically was a psychological component, the psychological component of wanting, the wanting mind. And we see sometimes how this shows itself. And I do feel it's very important in life to be with an awareness and a perspective which our particular mode of being is not considered in isolation. It's a little bit hard to understand, perhaps. But we tend to think of me and I as though me and I is unique, special, distinct, separate from other, countless other me's and I's. And if there can be some change in consciousness, so that even when you or I are thinking, I have, I want, I need, to know that I want, I have, I need, I must get, I should pursue, or whatever, is revealing itself and showing itself through countless situations, countless human beings. So that awareness is broader than just I, just me. Let's just take one or two outer situations first. In the way that we socially impact upon each other, what that means at a larger level, and then I would just like to bring it into the process of meditation and our relationship to all of that, because the two are not separate. There is this tiny kingdom in the far north of India, which some of you may have been to, northwest of India, called Ladakh, and has a Buddhist background and Buddhist history, and to some degree the implementation of various Buddhist values, which we might describe as tolerance, non-violence, loving kindness towards others and creatures, voluntary simplicity. All these are kind of values which those who have any exposure to a Buddhist tradition will be familiar with. And then it was found in the early 70s that this particular kingdom, small country, was undiscovered. Undiscovered, of course, means undiscovered by Westerners. And a trickle of people began to go in. And I have had a number of friends who were there many years ago, early 70s, and who made that trip up through Srinagar and Kashmir and then into Ladakh on what was a tortuous road journey. And they told me that in Ladakh at that time, there was no history whatsoever, as far as anybody can recall, of violence, of killing, and there were no padlocks. There's no locks on the doors. That just wasn't part of the paraphernalia of their life. And so some of the basic guidelines or precepts, shall we say, for living, non-violent and not stealing, and that basic human trust existed between people. Of course there are many failings there as well. There was acute health problems, education problems, poverty, etc., etc. Not denying any of that. As this invasion took place of people wanting to go there and the numbers increasing, what happened was that money, which was barely used, became very important. And there was much more buying and selling. And as this momentum began to build up, then people found that they had to buy locks for their doors. And 2 years ago, when I had a recent conversation with a friend who has been to Ladakh many, many times and has spoken extensively in the West and held slideshows about Ladakh, said that year there were two murders in Ladakh. And there is something which happened social, personally, shall we say, and socially, which somehow, with good intentions, like visiting an area, supporting a local economy and so forth, very easily leads to destructiveness. And then we have to look as people on the road, what we want and what that means in local economy, what that means socially. Now, in the same way, before I come back to this present situation, in Bhutan, which is a small kingdom, as you know, in the far northeast of India, and tiny little kingdom wedged between Tibet and India, there's a similar kind of situation as Ladakh was a number of years ago. Various kind of social problems and ills, which is a feature of the third world as well as the West. And the king of Bhutan and the council which runs there has and is saying, look, we don't want to repeat history. And they are being very selective and very careful with the number of people that go into Ladakh. And there's no advertising in Ladakh, there's no Coca-Cola in Ladakh, there's no casinos there, and there's none of the paraphernalia of Western urbanization. And yet, though there's some effort to protect the society there, the word is getting in, especially to the young people in the schools in Bhutan, that consumerism is the name of the game. And the King of Bhutan is very concerned about this, and he has written to a friend, Sulak Savaraksha, who runs the Thai, who's a Buddhist and was in prison for his beliefs for a period in a Buddhist country, amazing, in Thailand, and runs a Thai commission for development and cultural exchange. And Sulak and I are on the same board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And the King of Bhutan has said, I would like a Westerner to come to Bhutan, spend some months here, and the Westerner who, to put it in our language, is post-consumerist. You understand? A Westerner who's got values, who has an understanding, who has gone past consumerism, in order to speak with and to talk with the young people of Bhutan that consumerism and all its propagation, which is the most powerful religion on earth, is really not only is not where it's at, but it leads to all sorts of social ills and pains. And so there's some discussion amongst some of us about that, but it only expresses to me the degree of concern that we, I think, need to feel in terms of outer situations and the social implications of what I want. Because it's not just I, is it? It's we, the collective. And just as we need to reflect back and inquire into our own living social situation from wherever you and I are from, we also need to be aware of what that means living here, being here in this part of the world. And sometimes, in this what I want, one of the things which goes along with it is sometimes we simply can't have what we want. And the very force of this momentum brings dreadful psychological imprisonment. It's not unusual, and you may have experienced it in your life, and it's very common in places like this, where you meet somebody, a young person perhaps, or whatever, a young Indian, and his or her real wish is to go to live in America. It used to be England, but since the English economy fell into the pits, it's now become America, which is soon to join the pits, I notice. And so the person says, I've got a BA, and I want to go here and get this job and that job. And the desire, the wanting, is so strong that everything else within the country that this person is living in is completely unsatisfactory. One can't actually see, with such desire, any good anywhere around one. And so a country which is 2,000 miles by 1,000 miles, with a population of 750,000, actually, psychologically, becomes a prison. Because the mind wants to be out of this huge landmass and into another huge landmass. And the very desire creates imprisonment, psychological imprisonment. The imprisonment doesn't exist, but the mind, through its wanting and desire, believes it implicitly. And there are people in all parts of the world who experience this kind of psychological imprisonment. Dreadful, tragic situation to be in. And one of the things which we notice with ourselves is that sometimes in our experience, and as I was referring to it a little bit last night in this keeping in touch with ourselves, that when we're not sure, when we're feeling, experiencing some insecurity in some way or other, something's going on inside and we're not sure, but there's all that we know is there's a kind of movement, a sensation or unsatisfactory feelings, and we experience it in the form of, I don't know what my future is going to be. I can't say how long I'm going to stay in this area. I can't say what my next step is, what the next month is, or whatever. And when we're experiencing that uncomfortableness within ourselves, we try to compensate for it by resorting to thought. We want the thought to somehow or other fix things in a way for us in order to get these unpleasant, moving feelings quiet. I can't stay with this feeling. I really don't know where the hell I'm going or what I'm going to be doing next. And as an influence or result of this, we start planning. And the planning which goes on is not so much that it's a different sky and earth below somewhere else, because it really isn't, unless you go to England. And then you really want to get back. And then in that planning which takes place, the planning mind wants to feel comfortable by having some clear direction, some clear destination. And then we believe with this, once I am at point B, whatever that is, this is just in physical travelling, and it goes spiritual travelling, meditation travelling, it's all the same scenario. Once I get to this point B, and I've got some place of arrival, it will stay steady, I'll be okay. And it's such a compelling belief system that we somehow or other, we completely forget, how do we get here? We completely forget that we've actually gone through the same scenario our whole damned existence. And we still believe the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. That somehow it's going to be better there, or different there, or whatever. And what we forget is, how much of it is really outside of ourself, and how much is really how we are. And we think the world is going to make it just right for ourselves. Unparalleled naivety. Naivety, like truth, is boundless. Knows no limits. Maybe naivety is the ultimate truth. Anyway, we won't explore that tonight. And so this feeds in. Because there's some conflict inside, some unrest, some unsettledness, and frequently the only way we know how to try to deal with it is fix future. Get the future right, and I'll feel better about being here. And as you know, you sit here and planning mind and futurizing is a tremendous source of entertainment. And sometimes, unfortunately, because this social interdynamic we have with each other is that conversations leave impressions, and we do keep impressing each other. So when somebody says, have you been to? And that impression strikes, and it often feeds straight into the system inside of, oh yes, I want to. And this goes back and forth, and it goes back and forth with such frequency, or somebody says, I wouldn't go there. Whatever you do, it's terrible, terrible place there. And then someone says, it's fantastic. And one's got mixed messages. One doesn't actually have a clue because one hasn't been to the place. Who are you going to believe? The one who talks loudest and longest about the place? The one who shows the strongest suntan? Who are you going to accept? So, in countless numbers of scenarios which we have, as I say, thought is used as a means of avoiding not knowing. Now, when we come into a situation here, just as we see this internationally, and we see this wanting mind socially, and we see it personally, sometimes one of the very strongest forms of wanting mind, and it's very, very difficult because this is working very much at a feeling level inside of ourselves, and I think it's one of the primary driving forces in human beings, is the wanting of intimacy. And intimacy is frequently high on our list of priorities. And this shows itself in countless scenarios, projections and fantasies, women and men, and women with each other, and men with each other, and groups, and etc. All wanting the forms of intimacy. Intimacy is significant. And it does, shall we say, fall into a spiritual dimension. But frequently the way we think about the intimacy which we want is perhaps far too exclusive. And probably the most common form is intimacy, deep intimacy between two people. And this intimacy carries itself. So even sometimes on a retreat, you're sitting on the retreat, you perhaps don't know anybody who here before, and you've arrived here, and it doesn't take long, does it? Perhaps a few hours, or seconds, or a 500th of a second, to pick out the ideal. Some woman or some man amongst the number who is particularly interesting and is some wanting to make a connection. Now one's got problems on one's hands immediately. I want a connection with this person, but I hear this terrible news. I don't put this news out, by the way. I want to add that. We shouldn't make eye contact. I mean, never say that. But I say, if one does make eye contact, be incredibly watchful of what happens after it. But anyway, so we can't make contact. We're not supposed to make contact. And yet there's an impression of that woman, that man, and possibly in this situation you may, if you're honest with yourself, or some of you already know that you have somebody in mind. And I just remember, this is a social phenomena. If it's a social phenomena, I don't want to dishearten you, but you may be in competition with 20 or 30 other people. I mean, intimacy is ruthless. Really. Everyone for themselves in this line. Anyway. So somebody gets picked out as the object of one's perception. And it's remarkable what the mind can do with such little information. Because when there's no encouragement and no feedback and no response, and the other person probably not only doesn't know that you exist, but even worse, really knows that somebody else exists. So this goes on inside of oneself, and we call this on the circuit Vipassana Romance. Which has no basis in reality. There's nothing, not a possible angle which could say, well, there's some ground for this taking place. And yet the person is picked out. And then the person, the fantasy, begins to replay itself through sitting, through walking, and all sorts of events can be interpreted as being a kind of karmic, cosmic happening. It may be You know, that amongst that horrendous mess of shoes out there, the two pair of shoes find themselves together. Now, when you're coming in 8 or 10 times a day, there's a reasonable chance, and when sees that, knows that woman's shoes or that man's, and you look at them with adoring love. You know, sometimes a person is serving the food, and you're queuing for the food, and before you is intense with excitement about getting there first in case all the chapatis had been ripped off by the rest. And now this wanting mind has changed its form. The chapatis are not the priority. It's the server. And any little gesture, any little extra rice, and then it's smiling. It's all seen as being something's going on together. So this desire, this movement for intimacy, as I say, it's boundless. So sometimes we need to just catch ourselves, just to see this. Look at this phenomena that's going on. This component, this factor inside, which in its movement reads all sorts of things out in this world. And that's why I think in this kind of interest and work in life, I need a sense of humour, and most of all a sense of humour about oneself. If you lose your sense of humour, we might as well all pack up and go home or whatever. Then the other kind of movement and desire and wanting which takes place is in the spiritual field. Because I would say that intimacy, there are the conventional forms of it which are beautiful and meaningful and touching, if and how and when they occur, but there's also other expressions of intimacy, and if we're receptive to those, we can begin to sense and discover those expressions of it as well. And sometimes it's not through eye contact, and it's not through talking and conversation, and it's not through touch. Those are certainly ways and means towards intimacy in communication, and towards the heart's wishes, the heart's desires being fulfilled. But there are other avenues and expressions of intimacy, and to some degree or other, I think intelligent spirituality acknowledges those that I've just mentioned, but recognizes that there are other expressions of it as well. And those other expressions come through other ways and means, which we're not usually in access to. One of them is silence. Silence, awareness and that sensitivity towards silence, and the pervasive silence brings its own kind of intimacy, its own closeness with each other, in a way sometimes which all the words and all the touch and all the talking and all the eye contact just doesn't meet. It touches other levels of ourselves, not deeper, not more important, but gains access in other ways. One of the things which we experience here, and as is sometimes used in psychotherapy, and I think it's a very important reminder to us, is the sense within the scope of being here, and being in the room together, or being outside, is a deep appreciation, an immediate appreciation that one, that you, that we are actually, we're okay. And what happens, and it's been brought up in some of our small group meetings and does come up frequently, is a tendency which we have in which we feed into the wanting mind. Let me explain it a little bit. We come into the meditation room, or we do some walking meditation, or we queue for our food or whatever. And let us describe it as various sensations begin to occur. The sensations through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, feelings, thought, various kinds of sensations occur. And these sensations we then judge. We put a judgment on, and we would say, on ourselves. We judge ourselves. So as one person reported, if it doesn't mind me quoting, but the person said, well, I had two good sittings today, and then the first one was, I can't remember how it was described, very, very difficult, very troublesome or whatever. And so, but the person, what I hear saying is the person is describing what they're experiencing, perhaps the measure may be, if I sit still for a reasonable period of time, without being too ambitious about it, then, and I'd succeed in that, that's a good sitting. But if in the course of the sitting I move, therefore I experience different kind of sensations brought about through movement, then I've had a bad sitting or a difficult sitting. And then I've got two kinds of sittings, or two kinds of walkings, or two kinds of eating my meal, or whatever, and a whole variety. And so I keep looking at myself as doing good, not doing good, getting better, getting worse. The first day was really, I couldn't believe it, wonderful. But since then it's been a nightmare. And somebody said, the first day I couldn't get into it. Now I know I can't. Whatever. So there's this tendency in the pattern that we have to actually judge and compare our experiences. And this judging and comparing sets us up. It fragments us. It divides us. And it feeds the psychological factor, I want it back like I had, or I want something else. And the spur, the invitation to this fragmentation is comparing and judging. And therefore we might ask, we might invite ourselves that when we are experiencing various kinds of sensation, inner, psychological, emotional, physical, whatever the expression, why say that's bad, wrong, difficult, hopeless, frustrating, whatever? Why put that kind of negative description on some sensations? Why set ourselves up for it? Why say good and bad in terms of what's happening? And I'm not saying why in terms of looking for a cause, because one just goes on looking for causes, infinite past there. But rather, why, meaning, why not bring our attention and awareness to this? And then also what occurs is when we interpret what we're experiencing, and hopefully, you know, connecting here with how you've been interpreting today. Let's say it's going so-called, it's going well. One more judgment about it. It's going well. One is settling in, one is feeling at long last it's okay to be here, and one's got into some kind of rhythm. Then what very easily happens is, it's going along well, so if I put in some more effort, if I try a little bit harder, if I really work at keeping still or being focused or whatever, then the logic goes, it will get better. I'll get deeper. I'll get further. I might even get enlightened. And so even when things are so-called, it's only so-called, well, so-called, okay, in that respect, very easily we grasp onto that And in the grasping, we want more of it. Or we want it to go to something, somewhere else. And so even in the continuity of the satisfactory, if you can follow, I know it's an extremely long day, and if you're at this point in the talk completely spaced out, I completely understand and appreciate it, and please feel free to space out. Now, so even where there is a continuity of satisfactory meditation or pleasant meditation or whatever, how easily that in some way is dismissed, because one has the belief starts coming in, all the conditioning that you've heard over the years and from others and from books and so forth is, I want something even more. And so there's the experience of what we are, who we are, and in a way we have some kind of, not necessarily either memory, experiential memory, or memory from just conditioning with no experience, right, about something other. And this something other then becomes attractive. This is all self-rejection. This is undermining oneself. This is dismissing one's experiencing. It's disqualifying one's human experience to be what we are, where we are. It's divisive, it's fragmentary, it's saying, I'm not good enough, I can be this, I can be better, or whatever. It's setting up polarization, it's setting up comparing and judging, and countless personal social outflows. And it's no, to put it almost brutally, in a way what we're saying is, this experience, this sensation, I want to substitute it and bring in another. And I wonder, are we perhaps in that making too much fuss about a field of experience, about a sensation, about a little event that's going on in the cosmos? And somehow it seems that when we're trapped in that way, which in a way is another form of imprisonment for us, then we have no peace. We have no peace because this desirable unknown isn't available, because it's projected out there to the future, to another person, to another place or situation. So there's no peace there. And there's no peace here either, because this isn't it. This isn't good enough. This isn't big enough. This isn't the sensation that I want. So there's no peace in either way. And so can we view in such a way that we don't say, oh God, that means that this sensation, this knee pain is ultimate it, because there's nothing else. And that's just one point of view about it. And yet we don't also swing straight away to the other extreme and say, well, this is not it, and something else is. We don't have a view about it. We see the emptiness of taking up a position and a standpoint. Either there is only this, or this isn't it, there's something else. They're just positions which we take up when it suits us. And how can there be peace in just grasping one position or another? So they say basically we're okay. This knee pains, emotions arise, thoughts come, feelings come, events take place. It's okay. And I don't think we have to work terribly hard to be free human beings. I don't think it's that difficult and that long-winded and that complicated. I don't think we have to go through hell and high water to be free human beings. I don't think we have to have some special experience or a special sensation or whatever. I don't think we have to add anything to what we are. I don't think we have to subtract any. So that immediately we can be just free to see. And sensations come and sensations go, and we make a fuss about some of them, we don't make a fuss about others. I don't say that these sensations interfere with anything. I don't think they interfere with freedom at all. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings live with receptivity. May all beings be free to see. So let's have a couple of minutes quiet period together. Sure.